Maritime Matters, global perspectives through a German lens for the maritime industry. We bring the German perspective to the world and global insights to Germany. Maritime Matters is produced by the German Maritime Center, the think tank for the German maritime sector.
Welcome to our podcast. My name is Matthias Gatton. I'm the managing director of the German Maritime Center and your host.
My guest today is Professor Christian Büger. He is a professor at the University of Copenhagen, where he leads a research group focused on ocean infrastructure, and he is one of the directors of an international network on maritime security. He is also a research fellow at the United Nations Institute for Disarmament Research and an associate fellow at the Charles Telfer Center in Mauritius. Very exotic. Over his career, he has written more than 200 publications on international security and global governance, and in 2024, he published the book Understanding Maritime Security, which was published by Oxford University Press, and I guess we will touch upon some of the topics that are in that book in our conversation today. Christian's work on that, I think, makes him particularly well-suited for this podcast, bridges research and practice. He regularly advises decision-makers at the very highest levels. In 2025, for example, he briefed the United Nations Security Council, he briefed NATO and the European Council, and his research on piracy, ocean politics, and the security of our seas has featured in multiple media outlets, including Spiegel, Guardian, Politico, Al Jazeera, just to name a few. So very, very strong expert, both on the research side, but also well-versed in explaining topics to a broader audience. Welcome, Christian, to our podcast.
It's a pleasure to be with you today.
As I said, we will talk about maritime security, and most of us rarely think about it, although our daily life depends on it. The audience, of course, of our podcast will know that, depending on the number, somewhere between 80 and 90% of all goods are transported on the seas at some point in time. So that makes maritime security a vital issue. It's the backbone of our economy. But it's not only about cargo. Also, if we talk about internet traffic, we are recording this podcast via the internet right now. Our listeners will listen to it over the internet as well. And there are some estimates that almost all internet traffic runs through cables that lie on the seabed. So that is also a very important part of maritime security. However, the term means many different things to many different people. So let's kick off with a definition for people who don't deal with it on a daily basis. How do you explain the term maritime security? What does it entail?
That's a super important question. But before we go there, let's just add some additional facts, which is that 60% of our energy comes from the sea, and it's either generated through wind farms at sea, it comes to oil platforms and pipelines, or it is transported by the sea. And the moment that we witness a breakdown of this massive transportation network, as we are seeing it currently in the Strait of Hormuz, we all pay the price for it. And there's a larger trend also in the background, which Swedish researchers have called the blue acceleration. And that is whatever kind of activity we're looking at since the 1990s, whether that's shipping, cables, energy, and so on, there's a massive increase of activities at sea. And the sea is in many ways getting a quite crowded space, and we become more and more dependent on what is happening out at sea. And that implies vulnerabilities. And what the maritime security agenda is all about is addressing these vulnerabilities. So maritime security is a broad concept and agenda. The discussion in many ways started in the early 2000s. And first it was terrorism, maritime terrorism in the aftermath of September 11th. That was the biggest concern. And then gradually it became issues such as piracy, illicit fishing, smuggling of narcotics, and these kind of problems that were on the agenda. And today we are very much in this age of gray zone tactics. And that means subsea data cable protection problems such as the shadow fleet are really now in center. Key for maritime security is it's a concept and an agenda that connects other ocean discussions, and that includes national security and sea power. It includes marine safety, the safety of navigation. It includes questions of economy, how you can safeguard developing ocean economies. But it's also about people. It's about human security and resilience. And in this sense, it's really hard to define maritime security because it connects all of these concerns. And that's probably the best answer that I can give you today. It's a connector, and it captures certain kind of insecurities at sea that evolve over time, whether it's terrorism, piracy, or the current problems of sabotage.
I see. And of course, the maritime economy as such is extremely broad, extremely heterogeneous. So it makes sense in a certain way that also the topic of maritime security is very broad and complex and encompasses many different aspects. Now, you mentioned piracy, for example. Many people have a kind of an idea of shipping and seafarers. And maybe when they hear piracy, they have the idea of, you know, classical Caribbean pirates like the movies with a bandana and a hook. But it's, of course, a much more complex and very modern problem as well, right?
Yeah, the contemporary piracy looks a little bit different. We are basically talking about criminal gangs, organized criminal gangs, and then it depends a little bit. So the main pirate hotspots are in the Gulf of Guinea, off the coast of Somalia, and then in Southeast Asia. And the pirates of Somalia have become famous for kidnap and ransom model, and it was a huge problem between 2008 and 2012. And it was curbed down by an international naval coalition that, with broad international participation, Russia was there, China was there, the US, Korea, Japan, the European Union, and so on. So that was super successful in many ways. But over the last couple of months, we have seen a resurgence of Somali piracy activities, and that's slightly worrying. And in the other regions, in the Gulf of Guinea and in Southeast Asia, it's also a persistent problem. Right now, fortunately, at a relatively lower scale. So piracy can also mean guys climbing on board of a ship and stealing something. It's acts of robbery. So that continues in quite significant numbers in Southeast Asia, for instance. That's the current piracy situation. It's an important issue on the maritime security agenda, but it gets different amounts of attention depending on where the wind currently blows.
Of course. Yeah, there's many issues and problems that are vying for public attention. So some things very much in the spotlight while others fall through the cracks. Now, let me get back to the different aspects of maritime security that you mentioned. And there's also smuggling, of course, drug activities and stuff like that that are also related to criminal activities. If it is so broad and so vastly different, why does it still make sense to talk about maritime security as one concept rather than treating them as separate and independent issues?
Well, the key point is that they are interlinked in quite significant ways. And security at sea is really different from the land, not only because of the law of the sea being radically different structured, but in the sea, we also have the challenge of the high seas, the territory that belongs to no one, right? It's a significant portion of our planet. And many of these challenges are interlinked. If you have a maritime boundary dispute, the likelihood that criminals get active in that area is extremely high. And coming back to recent resurgence of Somali piracy, that is, for instance, driven by the crisis in the Strait of Hormuz. And it's driven by that in different ways. It's the Strait of Hormuz crisis has led to higher food and energy prices. So people in Somalia are poorer. The navies that usually operate in counter-piracy operations are busy with something else. And then on top of that, the Strait of Hormuz historically has always been used for smuggling operations. So that means that criminal networks have lost part of their income. And here you have three drivers of the current resurgence of piracy activities off the coast of Somalia. And I think it's a good example of how these challenges actually intersect with each other. And there are many more of these interlinkages. Smuggling, illicit fishing, extremist organizations feeding on starving coastal communities, and so on. And this is why it's quite important to have this maritime security agenda. It's not a reason development. The European Union issued its first comprehensive maritime security strategy in 2014, for instance. So it's clearly an evolving discussion that has been with us for 25, or at least in this comprehensive sense, for the last 10, 12 years.
But still, I find it quite recent if you say that it started in the early 2000s even to pop up as a topic of interest. I am actually surprised that it came so late, because it seems that these issues must have played a role in one way or another even before that. Now, of course, these topics of security in the classical sense, they are the domain of the public sector, the state. The state in most countries, you know, it's the one of the quintessential functions of the state is to provide security, safety issues. Now, as you mentioned, on the high seas, and especially, we have the problem that it's not under any national jurisdictions. It's not a lawless place, but it's governed not by national law, governed by a set of international laws and regulations. There's also the issue of policing, of course. Unlike, you know, in a city neighborhood, there's not a, you know, a police patrol around everywhere. The high seas are vast, and we see, you know, you mentioned the coast of Somalia, even that, which, you know, if you compare it to the big oceans, is a relatively confined area. But if you look at the distances, it was not easy, I think, for that international coalition to police that militarily. So in that sense, where does it belong to the public sphere? And where is these, are these security issues also the domain or the responsibility of the private operators, the ship owners, the shipping companies, and so on and so forth? Where do we sit in that maybe gray zone?
So that is a very important question. It's also linked to who should pay for what, right? And historically, in particular, the shipping industry has been arguing, well, they are paying taxes. Actually, they don't pay that much taxes. So states should provide guarantees. And then this can be either done through, you know, functions as a coastal state, as a port state, or perhaps most importantly, as a flag state. Under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, there's also a number of international obligations in terms of addressing piracy and fighting smuggling, for instance. But in the shift that has come along with maritime security, in particular in the 2010 years, is that it's clear now that the shipping industry has to take action on its own behalf. And in many parts of the world where there are high risk areas, it's quite common now that ships have armed guards on board. And the recent piracy incidents have also shown if you have armed guards on board, you can actually fight the criminal gangs off. They're trying to hijack your vessel. And many shipping companies now also work with private security companies in one way or the other to do risk assessments, to do routing, and to pay close attention to how self-protective measures can help. And that's Southeast Asia, the Red Sea. And there's actually quite a close cooperation between navies and the shipping industry, with a clear understanding that best management practices apply, that there has to be some level of self-protection. Same goes for the oil and gas and energy industry, where it's also relatively common that states only are the, you know, the backup option, so to say, while the first level of security is done by the companies themselves, to surveillance, to working with private security providers, and so on.
You mentioned the coalition off the coast of Somalia. That was an international coalition, including Western navies, Russians, the Chinese, and so on and so forth. Given the recent developments and the resurgence, one might say, of geopolitical rivalries, it seems to me that a coalition like that with those actors would not be possible as of now. I cannot imagine the US, European navies working together with the Russian navy, for example, at this stage. Has that change in the geopolitical circumstances made those kind of cooperation more difficult, and hence has the role of the state been reduced when it comes to policing or providing some sort of international maritime security on the high seas?
So the world is clearly changing, and my biggest concern is not rivalry between anyone, but actually geopolitical fragmentation, that, you know, the world is increasingly being governed in blocs and regional constellations and minilateral formats, and the way that the United Nations can deliver the work as they've done over the last 20 years is increasingly becoming difficult. Now, maritime security is relatively unique because there is a common interest between world states in terms of trade, in terms of planetary risks, actually to collaborate. And navies actually are the most international among armed forces. And in an interesting way, all navies around the world have a common enemy, and that common enemy is the weather. Right. So, and that's not the same for other armed forces. So there is the tendency to cooperate more. And I attend a lot of naval symposia and events like that. And there's a sort of like this mantra, no state can do it on its own. And there has to be cooperation. This is still with us. How it translates into practice is a little bit different than it used to be. But a good example now is discussion on what kind of military measures we can put in place in the Strait of Hormuz. And that's an effort that is currently led by UK, France, but also with Italy and Germany in the leadership. And that is now shaping up to be a broad coalition of up to 50 states that want to contribute to that.
But does it include countries that are clearly outside the Western camp, whatever that means nowadays?
For now, it doesn't include China or Russia. That has clearly changed. But I'm saying this to highlight that in many ways, the cooperative spirit is still there. It's getting more difficult. Another example, throughout the last year, we had a series of high-level debates at the UN Security Council. And at these debates, particularly the first one organized by Greece and the second one organized by Panama, we had more than 150 states that took the floor, and they almost all said the same thing. You know, we have to defend the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. We have to get better in information sharing and so on. So yes, geopolitical fragmentation is happening. At the same time, the spirit is still there. And that spirit is also based on very bare needs in terms of trade, in terms of energy, in terms of digital communication. This is why the facts that we started our conversation with are so important to keep in mind.
Nautical numbers.
Every episode, we ask our guests to bring a number to us that relates to the topic of the talk. Christian, what is your nautical number?
My favorite nautical number is that we always say that no one lives at sea. But it's actually not the case. About 5 million people were on board a cruise line last year. That's almost like a small state, actually, living not permanently at sea, but appreciating the sea. And it's a telling number in terms of how we're using the sea more for leisure purposes as well. And it tells us that we are making the sea a more crowded space for holidays, for energy purposes, for transport, and so on.
The cruise ship industry, yes, that is a booming industry as far as I understand. So the numbers keep growing. And that's an interesting point. That is a fairly new concept. It was actually invented by a German, the former head of Hapag-Lloyd, Albert Ballin, who was not the founding figures, but one of the key figures, I believe, in the history of Hapag-Lloyd, the German shipping company. And he, I think, invented this concept about 100 years ago or so, a bit more, that you could actually board a ship not to get from A to B, but for the sake of the voyage.
Exactly. And why does it matter to maritime security? I always kind of like this as a case, because many people are just not aware that the risks that they expose themselves by going on a cruise, because in many ways, these ships can be flagged in Panama or somewhere. That means if you go on a cruise line, you enter a different territory. Many people are not conscious about that. And that also means if your wallet gets stolen on board that ship, well, you have to file a claim with the police of Panama, right?
Yeah, it's true.
That's the flag state principle. And cruise lines in general, I think we have been lucky in the past. There's only two historical incidents of where extremist groups have attacked the cruise lines or passenger vessels. It's a risky space. We have seen so with kind of like the outbreak of diseases on board cruise lines. That's also a disaster waiting to happen, hopefully not in our lifetime, but everyone should be aware of the risks that they're actually taking when they're going on a cruise.
Fair point. Moving a bit closer to home, to at least to the home of our podcast, which is in Germany. Also, the more local waters have become the focus of concern when it comes to maritime security. After a series of incidents related to energy and communication cables under the Baltic Seas, NATO launched its Baltic Sentry operation in early 2025 to keep a closer watch on the infrastructure in the Baltic Sea. Germany sits right at the heart of this region, of course, as one of the Baltic Sea states, with major ports there, offshore wind industry, pipelines, and so on and so forth. That was actually a topic that I discussed a couple of months ago with your colleague, Nile Matzluk, who I suppose you know. And we also talked about the law of the seas and the surprising limitations that exist when it comes to policing this area. Outside of what I understand is strictly piracy-related issues there, the nation states do have some rights. But when it comes to these incidents with the shadow fleet in particular, where it's not quite clear, you know, what are these ships doing? Are they engaging in sabotage? Do they pose maybe an environmental risk because they're not well equipped to handle the cargo? Give us a little bit of an overview, in particular when we're looking at the Baltics and the increasing tensions between the Western European countries, NATO, and Russia. What kind of infrastructure are we talking about there, and what are the dangers of that infrastructure being dragged into the conflict in one way or another?
Yeah, the first thing to note is coming back to our earlier discussion about the blue acceleration is that this is a direct outcome of us becoming more and more dependent on the sea. And by us, I mean literally everyone living on this planet, and that includes Russia and all the other Baltic states. So the Baltic is a perfect example for an extremely crowded space, undercut with all sorts of infrastructures, energy cables, data cables, wind farms, oil and gas platforms, fishing activities, and so on. It's the classic, the more dependent we are becoming on something, the more we are vulnerable. And this has brought us the critical maritime infrastructure protection agenda. It's a relatively broad agenda linked to the question of what kind of infrastructure is actually critical and which one's not. Yes, cables have been cut in the Baltic Sea, but no one has ever lost the internet connection. So let's keep that in mind. We are now in this age of gray zone activities. The concept of gray zone is quite useful, because it tells us that we're in a space where different blacks and whites are involved. And one of them is the distinction between war and peace. One of them is the distinction between legal and illegal. One of them is the distinction between accident and sabotage. All of these events that have happened in the Baltic Sea are very difficult to classify. Particularly the cable cuts, were they actually deliberate sabotage, or were they just the outcome of poor seamanship and accident? This is extremely difficult to determine. And many of the issues on the maritime security agenda are now taking this character. So the age of gray zone is very much with us now. The other thing that I find quite interesting about the Baltic Sea is also how states now increasingly move towards developing maritime security solutions on the level of regional seas. That's a very, very good and interesting development. It, however, raises the question of, do we need solutions on a European level? Do we need solutions on a NATO level? Or do we need solutions for the Mediterranean, for the North Sea, for the Baltic Sea, for the South Atlantic, and so on? So this tension is not easily to be resolved. Final point. Yes, NATO has sent an operation there, but if it comes to critical maritime infrastructure protection, what the military can do is actually very, very limited. They can, and this is what this operation is primarily about, they can offer deterrence, but actually so much of what needs to be done is in the resilience space, and that requires coast guards, that requires industry action, that requires, to some degree, private security as well. Because the most important response to threats to subsea data cables is not a Navy response. It's just to build more cables, right? The more cables you have, the less the impact of one of them failing, whether that's by, through sabotage or through an accident. The next layer is repair them quickly. That's also not a Navy task. That's also an industry question, and so on. So much of that agenda is actually about resilience and industry and law enforcement agencies working together.
Yeah, redundancy, more cables, and then, you know, it doesn't really matter. Now, with cables, maybe that's easier than with other things. Pipelines, I assume, are more difficult to build because they're more expensive and probably more difficult to construct in redundancy. I mean, we have the one famous example of the Nord Stream pipeline that was blown up. I mean, it was not being used for other purposes anyway, but still, I guess if you're talking about pipelines such as that one, it's not that easy to say, well, let's just build 5, 6, or 7 in parallel and then we're good. So is that a solution to every issue when it comes to underwater infrastructure?
The Nord Stream case is really interesting. I think, first of all, it's important to recognize there is no total security or total protection. Like, there will always be a risk that one of these infrastructures either breaks down or is being attacked and so on. And that's then, requires a careful management of energy, right? So that you're not fully dependent on a single piece of infrastructure and you don't these single points of failure. The other one that is really interesting and that often does not get the attention that it should. Everything that we know about how the incident was carried out points to a small leisure yacht being used to carry out the attack. Now, how good are we in Europe or in the North Sea and the Baltic Sea in actually monitoring small vessels? The answer is quite shocking. Right? We do not monitor small vessels and leisure craft. It's totally legal to kind of like carry no equipment, to not report to anyone in the Baltic and the North Sea. That is usually not part of the discussion. The entire question of how are small yachts or smaller vessels being used. And it's one of the key gaps in the entire maritime security discussion. And I wish more people would pay attention to that.
Another issue that you mentioned, you mentioned the topic of resilience or redundancy. You also mentioned that, of course, the infrastructure itself, the cables, for example, they are usually private property. They belong to companies. They lie in international waters or on the seabed of international waters. So the jurisdiction question is also, I guess, a bit unclear. And the question is, you know, whose responsibility is it actually? Because you said redundancy and, of course, private enterprises. While redundancy may make sense on the societal level, from the perspective of an individual operator, redundancy is first and foremost costly. So it may not be done. Is that an area for regulation, for example, that the countries should demand infrastructure providers to cater for a specific degree of redundancy, for example, to ensure that they are able to maintain a service level defined in a particular way, even if something happens? And you said it can be an accident, it can be a deliberate act of sabotage, or it could also be, I don't know, a technical failure. I guess, you know, something also could happen with a cable that it breaks for completely different reasons without any external impact.
Yeah, the area of threats to underwater infrastructure is really broad. Sea quakes, for instance, are one of the main challenges, and you cannot do anything about that. Right? You can try to predict it. So subsea data cable protection is actually a beautiful example for what we discussed, the question of international cooperation and how it is changing and to which degree it is still there compared to the 1990s, for instance. I find it quite surprising and astonishing the level of international initiatives that we now have to work towards improving cable protection. 2 years ago, there was a New York Declaration, and that was led by the G7. A lot of states signed up for that, and that was the commitment to do more. Europe has, in the meantime, a subsea cable protection action plan that is really well funded. Singapore just launched an international initiative to harmonize how countries regulate subsea data cables, but also criminalize behavior. That's very important. The International Cable Protection Committee, the ICPC, and that's the main industry body issuing guidelines for states and laying out best practices of how to safeguard, then formed an international advisory group together with the International Telecommunication Union. Also, the European External Action Service has made this a priority issue under Kaya Kallas. So it's remarkable how much is actually happening on the international front. And to some degree, I wish that would be the case for other issues on the maritime security agenda as well, if it comes to smuggling or illicit fishing and so on.
Let's talk a little bit about the rules-based order at sea, which is, I think, at its core defined in the UNCLOS Convention, which came into force in the early 1980s. And of course, there are a lot of other treaties and sets of regulation around it, or in addition to that, some relatively old, some fairly new, such as the BBNJ treaty that just came into force. But generally speaking, are we actually progressing when it comes to rules-based order at sea, or is it not quite the opposite? We're retreating. We see more and more incidences where that order is not being respected, whether it's those incidences that we just talked about in the Baltic, whether it's the recent closure of the Strait of Hormuz, now subsequent attempts to maybe set up a toll booth there, which then led other countries to think, well, maybe we also have some straits where we could implement a similar system and make some money. So isn't the international rules-based order at sea at least strained or maybe even severely broken at this point in time?
So there's a lot of misunderstandings if it comes to the concept of the rules-based order. But first of all, the German philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein already told us that a rule doesn't contain the rule of how it should be applied. That means any rule is open to interpretation, and it also changes over time of what kind of expectations we have, how the rules should be applied. That's the case for all legal treaties, and that's also the case of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. Importantly, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea is one treaty among many. You've alluded to it, and if you actually pay more attention to the true thicket of international conventions and treaties, then we're getting more and more rules rather than less and less. And that largely happens in the framework of the International Maritime Organization, and the amount of new regulations that they actually have passed over the last 20 years is quite impressive. Environmental regime, but it's also humanitarian concerns, human rights at sea are increasingly a recognized issue, whether it's seafarers, migration, and cruise line workers, and so on. So there's actually a lot of things developing. We're getting more and more rules. The big question is, considering the blue acceleration, are we doing enough and fast enough? Because rules-based order does not only mean like following rules or, you know, engaging in contestation over how they should be applied, but also developing new rules. And what the Strait of Hormuz crisis, I think, tells us, we have been a little bit lazy, if not sloppy, to develop new rules of how straits should be governed, the laws of naval warfare, questions of humanitarian, international humanitarian law and how they apply at sea, questions of how, what is responsible and legitimate use of naval mines. These are all open questions, and we are now seeing that we have been very sloppy since the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea entered into force in 1994, to progress and to develop rules anticipating such situations could arise. And for me, it's also now a very important point to learn from the Strait of Hormuz to pay more systematic attention to the question, where are actually the gaps, where are the future crisis moments that we need to anticipate, and then start crafting both rules, but also institutions that can manage these challenges. This brings us back to the UN Security Council and the UN debate that is absolutely vital there as the core mechanism to get towards shared understanding between states, but also to address norm deficits and reinterpret the rules.
I understand, of course, the rules are the rules, and then the interpretation or the application of the rules is something very different, and that can be hotly debated, or, you know, at least in the case of national jurisdiction, is then usually decided by the courts in individual cases. But wouldn't you say that there is a material difference, maybe not just confined to maritime law, but international law in general, in that even 20, 30 years ago, international actors were frequently breaking international law, for sure. That's nothing new. But at least there was, by most players, the attempt to either get international buy-in, for example, through UN security mandate for an act of war, or at least to pretend in one way or another, even if it's like a flawed argumentation, that whatever the country was doing was somehow within the confines of the international order and international rules and regulations. Now, when we're looking at the actual current conflict in the Strait of Hormuz, neither Iran nor the US do even pretend to care about international orders or international law. It's just not being taken into account or even mentioned. Isn't that a material difference? And I know that the US, I think, is not a party of the UNCLOS treatment, so that is a legal differentiation here. But still, I think this conceptual change from, oh, I at least try to pretend that I'm following the international law, to I don't care at all. Isn't that a shift that we are witnessing?
And this is the trap of presentism. We always think that, you know, the moment that we're living right now is somehow special and different from what it has been in the past. Yes, the world is changing, but in the end, only the future historians will tell how significant these shifts actually were. And it's actually not true. Iran makes a lot of effort in trying to present its approach to the Strait of Hormuz in a way that follows UNCLOS, but also the earlier treaties. They're making a lot of effort in this, not in the beginning, but then now this is at the center. Then, or, you know, arguing that they changed the wording to respond to the law of the sea and so on. The United States has made a lot of effort in arguing that their naval blockade is legitimate and follows the laws of naval warfare. The U.S. has a couple of times tried via Bahrain to get a UN Security Council resolution for the Strait of Hormuz and the Iran crisis. If you would be right, why would they bother? Right? If it's actually the case that international institutions and international law doesn't matter anymore, why bother, you know, even kind of like justifying the blockade? Why trying to have a UN Security Council resolution? And so this is very much alive as a space. It has become more complicated, yes, because of geopolitical fragmentation that has come back, or there's a new wave of having that. But it doesn't imply that international law is no meaningless. This is like diplomacy, you know, and this is how we do international relations. There's the military, there's diplomacy, and there's law, and there's trade. And these are the four core instruments of how international relations is being done, right?
Yeah. I mean, I agree that, of course, only historians will be able to tell in the future what kind of times we are living in. And I also agree that we should be very careful in not using terms such as unprecedented, which is often thrown around. We live in unprecedented times of turmoil. That's probably not true if you compare it to other periods in history that were much more violent and much more uncomfortable for the people living in those times than what we live in now, at least for the most part of the population. But still, let me make one distinction. And I think that is as true, at least as far as it comes to the US. That may be true, and you're much more into the details than I am, but I think it is happening on a much lower, maybe technical level. I would be very surprised to see the President of the United States or any of the cabinet members talk about the importance of upholding the international order and how the US is currently championing that. So that is not happening. And for example, in the previous Gulf Wars, for example, that did happen, right? President George W. Bush and his ministers, secretaries, they made a very public effort themselves to promote this idea that they were within the confines of international law. That for sure has changed.
Absolutely. In that sense, you're right. And the phenomenon in the background is the decline of US hegemony. And let's face it, you know, the main guarantee of freedom of navigation and maritime security for decades has been the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Coast Guard. That role is now gone, and we're moving from the space that is relatively clearly governed by a hegemon that loves international law. We're now moving to a sea space that is more fragmented, more contested, and so on. We have lost the champion of kind of like preaching a certain version of the U.N. Convention on the Law of the Sea. And of course, if you think about some of the attacks by the U.S. on merchant vessels, right? I mean, they killed three Indian seafarers as part of enforcing the blockade, right? And claimed that it was lawful. They have killed more than 200 people on vessels which were accused of carrying narcotics into the U.S. And Law of the Sea scholars from the United States have been defending this as being lawful because it has to be interpreted as an act of war and da-di-da-di.
Navigators Table.
Especially if we're talking about important international topics, complicated issues, crises, we need to be well nourished. So that's why We ask our guests to bring some restaurant or bar recommendation to us. Can be any place around the world, something that is somehow related to the maritime world, the seas. Christian, what is your recommendation to our listeners? Where should they go?
3 years ago, I started to spend my winters in the beautiful island of Mauritius in the Western Indian Ocean, because the winters in Denmark are harsh, cold, and unbearable. So everyone should make it to the beautiful island of Mauritius, in particular in the European winter.
One of my favorite spots is a tiny barbecue place on the east coast of Mauritius, very close to Port de Lafayette. And they serve fantastic fresh seafood over lunchtime. And whenever you make it to Mauritius, you really have to go there and enjoy the view and the amazing seafood that they are serving there.
We've already come to the end of our episode. We have not been able to touch upon all the issues, which was kind of clear from the beginning when Christian mentioned how vastly complex this field is. But we were able to touch on, I think, some that are fundamentally important for the world that we live in. Christian, thank you very much for this interesting topic. And I would love to have you back at some point in the not too distant future, where we can then talk about the many other issues that we were not able to talk about today.
Thank you for listening to this episode. I hope you learned something new. If you like the show, please leave us a review and a rating on your favorite podcasting platform. And don't forget to check out the show notes and more information about the German Maritime Center at maritimematters.de.